السلام عليكم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على رسوله الأمين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. أما بعد، I always say that I don't believe in punishing those who come early, and since you're here early, it's not fair to make you just sit and wait for those who are going to come late. So I thought we'll do a quick review of yesterday. I have to hold it like this. No? Okay. I can't use that one. Same, huh? Okay. طيب. Okay. So we're saying a quick review of what we covered yesterday. Things we defined what da'wah meant, and we always see that it's you getting people closer to Allah Azza wa Jal to become better worshippers of Allah. It's never about you, your group, your sheikh, your, I don't know, whatever, madhab. It's not about that. It's about Allah Azza wa Jal. We saw that it comes from the root du'u, which means to invite. So therefore, it cannot be a fight. It cannot be a debate. It cannot be an argument. Then we made the argument for what's the bare minimum I have to mention before someone becomes Muslim. We said the prerequisites to taking the shahada is to remove shirk and establish that Allah is the only one worthy of worship and Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is his messenger. If the guy has a dog, you can still give him shahada. Oh, if he has a dog, no, you have to get rid of your dog first. If he has tattoos, remove the tattoos, then we'll take the shahada. That's not from the prerequisites of becoming a Muslim. And again, even if the guy has a girlfriend, many times, if the guy has a girlfriend, I don't give him the shahada. How long have you been going out with her? 3 months? Okay, 3 months you can do a phone breakup. Just break over the phone with her. If it's longer than that, it has to be face-to-face out of yani adab. No such thing. No such thing. Okay. طيب. So we argued that because I might say, look, just tell people about Tawheed, the Prophet ﷺ, and the five pillars of Islam. And then someone will say, what about khushu'? Okay. Or what about Umrah? Hajj is important. What about Umrah? Then someone else will add another thing and another thing. And in the end, then we'll have the pot will be full of things to say. But we said if we boil it down and let everything evaporate, what's the bare minimum I have to tell someone before they'll become Muslim? And we were trying to convince you on this is the bare minimum. And a lot of years and years of collective du'at and their experience says this is the bare minimum. And it's... can I borrow your book, Rami? This is these are the course notes, huh? There we go, page 70. Okay, I need a volunteer. I'm just gonna ask you a question. It's a very simple question. Who's my volunteer, brother or sister? You're not gonna do anything. I'm just gonna ask you how long it will take you to memorize something. You just tell me how long. I'm not gonna ask you to memorize it. Volunteer. Okay, I'm going to call on someone. I'm going to call on someone in 5 seconds. Someone volunteer, I'm going to call randomly. Huh? You're my volunteer. Yes. No, you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to go anywhere. Just sit down. I'm just going to ask you. I'm going to tell you some words. Tell me how long it will take you to memorize these words in the exact order, in the order I'm going to say them. Just tell me how long you think it might take you. All right? Effort. Ad-Duri. V. Abdul Ghafoor. Recitation, great, put, Quran, into, in, of, and the last word, memorizing. How long would it take you to memorize these words in this exact order? How long would you need? 10 to 15 minutes. Yeah? What do you think? How long? Sister, how long would it take you? Sorry, 20 minutes? Yeah, I'm talking to you. How long? 10 minutes? Okay. Now, how about now? I'm going to put them in a different order. Abdul Ghafoor put great effort into memorizing Quran in the recitation of Ad-Duri. How long now? You can say it back to me, I think. Abdul Ghafoor put great effort into memorizing Quran in the recitation of Ad-Duri. That's it. So this is the difference between when you organize thoughts and ideas and you take someone through a channel, yeah? From point A to point B versus just, JazakAllah khair, thank you Rami, throwing random bits of information at people. Many du'at have this technique where they've memorized the best, their favorite things in Islam. Favorite hadith, favorite ayat, scientific miracles. And when they meet a non-Muslim, they throw one here, something nice from the seerah. something about taking care of animals, something about planting trees and being nice to nature, something about a scientific miracle in the Quran, something about what the Quraysh did to the Prophet ﷺ, how he forgave them, something about taking care, being merciful on the children and being this with the elderly. And hopefully, when this non-Muslim goes home, something will stick. But that's not a good technique. We're saying it's better to have organized thoughts that go from point A to B, which is the Shahada. We said you're going to build on something. And the first thing you have to build your conversation upon is a solid foundation, a solid concrete slab. If you're going to build a pyramid, you have to build on a very solid foundation. We said that is the belief in the Creator. So the first question is, do you believe in a Creator? If you're dealing with an atheist, you click on the atheist file. You're not going to say, well, this Creator, he sent a prophet. The person's atheist. So if there's a Creator, we said, how do you ask about the Creator if someone believes in God? What kind of question? Close-ended question, meaning a question where the answer is a yes or a no. I don't have time for your philosophies. And tell me, you know, what's your view on God? Oh, the guy's going to tell you his life story. I don't need that. Do you believe there is a Creator? Yes. So from the Creator, we link to the prophets, and it has to be. If there is a Creator, how would we know about him? The most logical way, prophets. He will not appear to people in person. He will not send angels. And if he sent angels, as he said in the Quran, وَلَوْ جَعَلْنَاهُ رَجُلًا وَلَوْ جَعَلْنَاهُ مَلِكًا لَلَوْ جَعَلْنَاهُ رَجُلًا وَلَلَبَسْنَا عَلِيهِمْ مَا يَلْبِسُونَ So if we would have sent an angel, we would send him in human form, and then we would have confused them about an issue that was already confusing. So Creator, prophets, and prophets now I want to talk about two specifically. Isa alayhi salam, because in this story, for example, I was talking to a Christian. If you're not, you can actually skip that one. True or false? If the guy is not a Christian, what's the insistence on mentioning Isa alayhi salam? Then Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam. And in this example, we were saying, is it logically possible Allah sent Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam as his messenger? Is it logically possible he sent Jesus as his prophet and not as his son? And it's logically possible. You cannot say no to that. From here we said, you mentioned the five pillars. What about the six pillars of Iman? What about? One time, I was teaching this procedure, and then a brother said, I attended a da'wah course, and in this da'wah course, they said that you should mention the six pillars of Iman. And therefore, you didn't mention the six pillars of Iman. Why not? Tayyib, again, we just want to apply a rule. Someone gave us a rule, and I just want to apply it. But you got to think about it. In our story, the police officer was what? What was his religion? Baptist Christian. What is the value? Why do I have to mention the six pillars of Iman to a Baptist Christian? Why? Doesn't he believe in most of them? And is it something that I need to fine-tune at this moment? Not necessarily. What are the six pillars of Iman? One, Allah, Prophets, Angels. Okay, let me teach you an easy way to remember the six pillars of Iman. Okay? Very easy. Allah sent his angels to give his books to his prophets so they can warn people of the last day. Allah sent his angels to give his books to his messengers so they can warn people of the last day. And all this is part of the Qadr of Allah, right? So this is a Baptist. I already spoke about this. Does he know Allah now? Yes? Prophets? Does he believe in the angels? He's a Baptist. Does he believe in angels? Books? Yeah? They have the Psalms. They have the Torah. The five books of Moses. They've got all that. So he believes in the books. He knows about Allah. He knows that there are prophets. They believe in the last day, Baptist Christians? Yes? And what was the last one? Well, before Qadr, we're never going to get into it anyways. True or false? I mean, there's no da'i on the planet where Qadr is one of his first talking points when he meets a non-Muslim. Let me explain Qadr to you. Not a good da'i if he does that, yeah? Unless you are in this weird situation where you meet someone who knows everything, but Qadr is his only problem with Islam. Then spend time on Qadr. But otherwise, don't bring it up even. So, this brother just wanted to mention the six pillars of Iman because the course said mention the six pillars of Iman. That's why we warned, remember yesterday, of just having these rules and just following them blindly. And that's my personal issue with du'at making rules for da'wah. Da'wah is very situational, very situational. You can't make rules. And every rule you make, there's one port or another where it can be broken. There's a very famous da'iya, and he used to have a da'wah workshop, and he started the da'wah workshop like this. He would say, this is in America, you only give da'wah if you're African-American. Only. And there was like maybe four African-Americans in the audience. So basically it's like saying if you're Arab or if you're from Indo-Pak region, get out. You know, you can't. Why can't they give da'wah? Who made this rule up? Da'wah is so situational, so many different scenarios and elements that it's impossible for me to say, this is a rule you have to follow every single time. Almost impossible. There might be a few exceptions, we're going to look at them, but almost impossible. You can't believe the different reasons why people become Muslim. There's one story I told. This guy, someone asked him, how'd you become Muslim? He said, I was buying drugs from a drug dealer. And while we were making the exchange, I'm giving him the money, he's giving me the drugs, he just said something. You know, he's making conversation. He's this good customer service from the drug dealer. So he's having conversation with the customer. He said, you know who the best people are? Those Muslims, they are the best people. Yeah, so that'll be $50. Okay, here's your drugs. That's all he said. The guy said, I went home, smoked everything and all that. He said, I woke up in the morning, said, the drug dealer said the Muslim people are the best people. He started to look at, googled Islam, and he became Muslim. He became a speaker. Yeah, you know what that means, right? What does that mean? Yeah, we have to sell drugs. Yeah, to sell drugs. It is so situational. Well, like one guy, a friend of mine asked him, how did you become Muslim? He said, I don't want to tell you because you will laugh at me. He said, I promise I won't laugh. He said, one day I entered a public bathroom and I found all these grown men putting their foot in the sink, washing their feet. No one washes their foot. Sometimes at work, at the office bathroom, you find the Muslims washing their feet. Non-Muslims are so, what are you doing? You know, this guy told me there was a guy in his office, they used to call him the foot guy. Because it would catch him washing his feet. Like, why do you have to wash your feet in the middle of a work day? What's wrong, Yani? You know? So, he said these grown men were washing their feet, and that moved him. It moved him. How would it move him? Because you are washing your feet to stand in front of your Lord, this is the utmost respect. And that made him become Muslim. So da'wah is so situational, so many different variables. How can you make rules and say, you have to do it like this? One time, this guy called me up. He said, I know how I'm going to give da'wah from now on. I said, how? He said, I'm going to organize Islamic nasheed concerts and people will take shahada. I said, I don't think people become Muslim from nasheed concerts. He said, no, they do. I was at a nasheed concert last weekend and there was a non-Muslim in the audience and he came up on stage and he took his shahada. What's wrong with this evidence that this is a good da'wah technique? What's wrong with it? Hand. Anything wrong with it? You think it's excellent? Yes, sir. This guy, on what basis did he accept Islam? Okay, very good. Yeah, basically, all you see is a guy coming on stage and taking his shahada. But what was the story behind that? Maybe he lives with Muslim roommates for the last 3 months. They took him to Jum'ah, they gave him kebab and biryani and all this stuff. They gave him everything. They took him to events. So I don't know what happened. Basically, what you see is just one data point. The guy takes his shahada on stage. How do you know he took shahada from the words of the lyrics? Or Rehan, the guy, their voices. The guy says, khalas, ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. You don't know that. So this is the problem. Just one data point, one event, this is it. There's a sister and she's got a PhD in statistics and she said never ever give this copy of the Quran to non-Muslims. And this is a copy that if I were to estimate, they're probably in the millions have been distributed. This in the old days, it was just this one copy. She said never give it to non-Muslims because it offends them. And she has a PhD in statistics. What happened? She gave it to one person. We've been handing it out for at least, as I can remember, at least 17 years, this copy. In the millions. And she said, never give it because it offends them. Who's them? She gave it to her professor and he didn't like just a small part in the translation. and she has a PhD in statistics. One guy, it depends with him. Don't ever give it out. So we do that a lot. We want to follow rules. We want to create and invent rules for people to follow for da'wah, and that doesn't work. The best thing is to learn the tools and then use the tools in different scenarios and different situations. For example, when you go buy a hammer, from the store, you know the tool and how it works, and then you use it in all kinds of creative ways. True? So there's a nail, I have to drive it, I'll use it to drive a nail. I need to break something, I'll use it. I need to break some ice, I'll break the ice with the hammer. It doesn't say in the package, break, you can use it for ice, you can use it for... You know the tool and how it works, and you can use it and apply it in different scenarios. You need to discipline your child, you can use it. So, different ways, yeah? So the point is, getting the tools. Some trainers, they like to tell the audience, this is how to respond if someone says this. And if someone says that, say this. And if they say that, say that. I cannot give you every possible scenario, but it's better to give the students the tools and then they can answer their own questions. And I used to do this in the old days. We'd give students the tools, then I would give them a real religion. Who's heard of five percenters? Five percenters, yeah? And I'll give them an argument from the five percenters that they never heard before. But they're able to refute it in a few minutes. Why? Because now they have the tools. I can't give you every scenario, but I can give you the tools, and you use them in any scenario. All right. So we said we mentioned the five pillars because many times people are afraid to enter a religion they don't know anything about. So you spoke to me for 7 minutes. Everything you said sounded nice, but I can't become Muslim just on 7 minutes of good speech, change my whole life. So I need to know more. I need to read this religion more. So when you mention the five pillars, you remove that fear. I'm going to tell you about the most important things. And if they don't scare you away, what are the chances something of lesser importance will scare you away? I need more time to think. And then you give them that car analogy. And we actually use the car analogy. Okay, if I have a car right now, what would you examine? Then would you keep the car or not? If the person says yes, why? Because the most important ingredients agreed with me. Okay, well, the most important elements in the religion of Allah agreed with you. You agree with all this, you have what it takes to be a Muslim, do it right now. Say it and become Muslim. Okay. Let me ask you a question now. What do you think now in America, what do you think is more effective as an attire, what to wear for da'wah? Do you think it's more effective to wear a full thawb, you know, the Arab thawb, and give da'wah in the street? Or do you think it's more effective to wear like a nice shirt and pants, and then give down the street like that? Who thinks shirt and pants, put your hands up? Yeah? Who thinks the thobe is more effective, put your hands up? Half a sister even, because she went like this, so. one person thinks maybe the thobe is more effective. Okay, so those who said the shirt and pants are more effective, are you just taking a guess? Who is not taking a guess? You're not guessing about the shirt, that the shirt is better than the pants? Like from those who voted for shirt and pants, were you guessing or do you have certain knowledge? Guessing, right? For sure, I think everyone was guessing. And I was asking you to guess anyways, right? Right? Now, from collective years, collective du'at, not just like one guy, yeah, but many du'at we've spoken to over the years, and du'at who've been giving da'wah for years, specifically street da'wah, talking to complete strangers in the street, we actually found that there is almost no difference between what you wear, if you're wearing shirt and pants, versus a thawb. But believe it or not, there's a slight advantage to the thawb. Why? Because the thawb, number one, it brings you da'wah. People will come to you and say, what are you? You know, one time I was at a restaurant in Ethiopia. A lady came to me and said, excuse me, are you a rabbi? I said, yeah, I'm a black rabbi, yeah. They do exist, but people don't know that. Yeah. The point is, they bring you da'wah. And one time I said this in a workshop, and the brother didn't believe it. And next Friday, he's going to Jum'ah in Ethiopia. A non-Muslim came to him and said, hey, tell me about this. So he believed. That's one. Number two, when you're giving da'wah in a thawb, you appear more credible to people. Like they think you're a clergy or you have a rank. We don't have a rank system in Islam. but they think you have a high rank within your religion, so you understand, you know what you're talking about better, you look more credible. So there's a slight even advantage to wearing a thobe. But I'm also sure you can think of a scenario where it's not a good idea to wear a thobe. Yeah, I'm sure. But what I'm trying to say is that we sometimes base things off of what my intuition, what I think is the issue. Yesterday, and the reason I'm bringing this up is that yesterday I asked a question. I asked, would people be offended in Malaysia if you go to them and start talking about religion? And a lot of people in the room said yes. And then some du'at who've done it multiple times said no. So, and I don't know the country. So I'm saying, have you tried it and you found people to be offended? Or are we just very reserved and very cautious? I don't want to offend anybody. So therefore, yes, people will be offended. Yeah. This happens all the time in America. Like part of the course, we're trying to encourage people, go out and speak to people. They won't be offended. And ask people for the shahada. They won't be offended. And people, sometimes one brother told me he pushed himself to give da'wah to someone. He said, I started sweating, my face got red, and I was so embarrassed. And the guy started thanking me, thank you so much for sharing your religion with me. Yeah. So what he thought is going to be offensive. Why? And this is another thing. And can I not approach someone and speak to them about religion without it being offensive? What is it about Islam that if I speak to someone about it, they'll be offended? That's not true. You, as a da'ya, you have to make sure that when you give da'wah to someone, that is a wonderful encounter for them. They can go home that night and say, you know what, I met a wonderful Muslim today. We had a great conversation. He explained a lot of things. He was very polite. He never interrupted me. They should speak like that about your encounter. If they don't, you need to improve your da'wah skills. That's what I always tell du'at in the UK, because they just fight with people. But I told him, if the non-Muslim goes home and says, I met this rude, obnoxious Muslim, and he just kept arguing and trying to convince me, and he was interrupting me, then you failed. And that's not the way of the da'iyah. And one amazing thing, if you read the seerah of the Prophet, you will notice that he never, you know what never means? Never interrupted anyone. Unbelievable. And they're insulting him. They'll sit down and say, if you're mad, we'll bring you a doctor. If you're doing all this because you want women, we will wed you to a very beautiful woman. If you want money, we'll give... He just kept talking and talking and talking. The Prophet never interrupted him. Imagine that happens to you now. Brother, why have you a beard like that? Huh? You want women? I'll find you women. Ah! Dare you. You get upset. Tell him immediately. I'm not good, lay women, yeah. So, but the Prophet was very patient. Then he said, Afaraght, are you done? And then he called him by his kunya, patronymic. And then he said, Fasma' minni. And then he responded. Never interrupts people. So if you're going around interrupting, making people uncomfortable. So you say, if I talk to someone about Islam, they'll be offended. Then there's something wrong with your technique. Can't you speak nicely to people? Haven't you spoken about other subjects with people and they weren't offended? You spoke about sports, you spoke about weather, you spoke about this and this kind of food and the best restaurant with strangers before, and no one got offended. So why did they have to get offended when you speak about Islam? So watch how you present it. And why is it that if the Muslim goes and nicely with a good smile and good manners invite someone to Islam, they'll be offended? But Jehovah's Witnesses are running all over the place calling people. I don't even know Malaysia, but I'm sure Jehovah's Witnesses give da'wah. True or false? Okay. They do. Alright? So they give da'wah and no one says, well, no, if Jehovah's Witnesses speak to people. Jehovah's Witnesses, when they sit in their gathering, they don't say, people be offended when we go speak to them. They go and they think they have the truth and they're calling people to falsehood. And we have the truth and we're like, people will be offended from the truth. I would rather they burn in the hellfire for all eternity. Doesn't sit right, wallah. Doesn't sit right. Has to be a wonderful encounter. Don't think, this is the deen of Allah. How is not something offensive. We didn't say go to someone in their face and use bad words and profanity. That's offensive. We can't equate calling people to Allah like to that, to something so offensive. Can we start now, inshallah? The thing? Now, people are shy. I'm shy. How do I walk up to a stranger? I'm going to show you a fun technique. But if I show you this technique, you have to promise to use it. Deal? Okay, if anyone's not going to use it, leave now, please. I don't want you to hear the technique. I'm serious. Okay, that means everyone's going to use it, yeah? it's if you can't use this technique, go dig a hole and just sit inside it. I'm telling you, I'm not kidding. No, it'll come. It's not on the slide. This is just me speaking. Yeah. So if you can't use this technique, just dig a hole and sit inside the hole. Okay? And put a durian in the hole so it stinks in the hole also. Because you don't deserve to be in a clean hole. Okay, it's really simple. And I did this just a few weeks ago. I've been teaching this for years, and the other day I said, let me try it. So you pick up your phone. It's called indirect da'wah. Pick up your phone, and you can actually call someone for real, or just speak to nothing. If your phone rings, you'll be embarrassed, but just speak to nobody. I want to give da'wah. I was at the doctor's office the other day, and I used this technique with my wife. I'm talking to her. I'm telling her a story. There was a lady sitting across from us. She's not reading anything. She's bored. She's going to start listening to our conversation. Even if it's not their business, people love to eavesdrop. Yeah? So I gave her everything I want to tell her in the world, I told this woman. Yeah? I could have said anything I want to say to her. I'm speaking to my wife. Yeah? I'm in the elevator. My friend who always will say something about da'wah to each other, but the people who are listening. We're waiting in line for something, to buy tickets for something, or we're, you know, in the bus, we speak to each other, on the train, we speak to each other, and it's really for everyone else. On the train, pick up, start speaking to a friend, or just nobody, an imaginary friend. A guy came to me at the office, he said, my boss, my manager does not allow me to speak to anyone in the office about religion. I said, how does it work in your office? He said, we have cubicles. I said, fine, during break, pick up the phone, and start speaking to someone, or just to nobody. Talking about and loudly, and then everyone else will eavesdrop. And if you can pique their interest enough, they will actually come and say, you know what, I heard you, I couldn't help but over here you said this, this, and that. How does that work in Islam? Now they can't complain to the manager because they came to you, right? So you pick up your phone and you start talking. So let me finish the story I started last time. So basically I told the man, since Allah is the one who gave you your health, your eyesight, your intelligence, doesn't it make sense to only worship Him, to only obey Him, instead of worshiping something else with Him, a tree or a rock, and just keep going on like that, you know? Whatever you want to say. I just used it 3 weeks ago. So now she's the kind of an old, stubborn lady that if you say anything in front of her, she starts screaming. And if you speak to her, try to give her nice advice. So I gave her, I said everything that was here, everything I wanted to say, I said it to her. And she didn't say a single thing. She didn't bat an eyelid, you know? Nothing. Why? Because I was on the phone talking to somebody. And I wasn't talking to anybody. Yeah. And I just kept going about hadith after hadith, the excellence of the companions, and the ones that they insult. And what if Allah brings you on the Day of Judgment in front of this companion? Who do you think will win? You will win, and then the companion will lose. You will lose. And she was like this the whole time. I don't think in her life, and she's an older lady, probably never heard a full lecture like that, because this is the top. She'll just interrupt anybody. You could bring her, you know, Mufti al-Haram, she'll cut him off, you know. But this time, because I'm on the phone, everything I wanted to say. Indirect da'wah. If someone is just can't do anything on this earth, they can pick up the phone and give indirect da'wah. So everyone's going to try it? Because it's impossible that you can't try it. Just pick up the phone and start talking so people can hear you. Yeah, you can even do it with Muslims. Someone, you know, whatever, you know, someone has an issue with hijab, you know. Okay, fine. Yeah, so some people say hijab is not part of Islam. What kind of religion? What kind? Just keep, go through with it. Yeah, it's really easy, but you have to try it. And it's so effective. We taught this technique early, and some years ago. And the first time, at the university, where I was chaplain, yeah. And the sisters start to use it everywhere. Even in the bathroom, they would talk to each other about the purpose of life. They said, sometimes people look at us funny and walk out. This one time a sister was washing her hands, she just looked at them and walked out. Then another sister came out of the stalls and she said, I couldn't help overhearing that. No, she washed her hands first. Then she said, I couldn't help overhearing you guys talking about, the purpose of life. What is the purpose of life? Yeah. Anytime they're standing there, they're waiting in line at the restaurant to buy their sandwich, whatever. Talking about the purpose of life, about Allah and Islam, and about halal, haram, right, wrong, anything. It's so effective. If someone is offended, make sure you don't offend people. But if somebody were offended and they come to you, I don't like what you're saying. Hold on a second. Excuse me? Who's rude now? Who's rude now? And it's just, no one can, inshallah, no one can do anything to you. Because I'm just talking, I'm sorry, hold on a second. Who are you? What's going on here? Did I say anything to you? Okay. Fantastic, wonderful, we're on. Remember I was telling you about a technique of thinking out, getting people to step outside of their box, yeah? So the issue is sometimes you wonder, why would someone believe in this? Why would you believe in something like this? What kind of a belief system is this, you know? So, for example, believes in transmigration, that you can be a human being. If you don't get enough good karma, you can become a mouse in the next life or a rat. And then, also from rat, you can go back to human again. Oh yeah. So, then you ask simple questions just to get people thinking. So, one time I asked one person, she said, I'm Buddhist. I said, do you believe in transmigration? You can go from human to rat, rat back to human. She said, yeah, that's my religion. I said, now, let me ask you something. I'm not trying to be funny, but what kind of good deeds does a rat do so to make sure in the next life he becomes a human again? And the rat wakes up and says, you know, I shan't steal any cheese today. What does the rat do? So the minute I asked her that question, she said, well, it's not a religion, it's more of a philosophy. A philosophy, 2 seconds ago it was a religion, now it's a philosophy. So, you wonder, like, about how someone can create a god out of his own, with his own hands, and then worship that god. Yeah? Like how the pagans used to do. Create a god, and then worship them. I made you, and now I'm asking you, protect me, help me. Yeah? Amr ibn al-Jamuh, okay, let me just get... Or why would someone who's intelligent believe that there are three gods that are one? How can three things be one? How can three things in physically separate places be one thing? One in essence doesn't mean one. If I give you, if I put three bottles of water on the table, say how many bottles of water are on the table, you say, well, they're all water and all plastic. So therefore, it's just one bottle that it's in front of me. Now I would say, if that's how you think, I would like to borrow 300 of the 100 ringgit bill. Well, I'll just give you one back, you know, and then one in essence you can, as one guy told me, one times one times one is one. God the Father, the Son, the Spirit, one times one is one. But first of all, we wouldn't use multiplication. If you loan me $100, I won't give it you just one, say multiply as much as you like. So the question is then, why would someone be inside, think, not see something wrong with that? Maybe you've seen that video of the man in the rat temple in India. Yeah? There's a rat temple. I played it at the course, so we don't have time for it now, but it's just a short video. This man, he takes care of rats in the temple, and he believes he's doing very holy work. His family is chosen to take care of these rats who are reincarnated humans and they're gods, and they eat with the rats, and rats urinate on their head. It's just disgusting. But he thinks he's doing something holy. You see a man with rats on his head. That's all you see. You don't see any of the, oh, nice. No. He feels that way, but you don't. You just say, look, you know, you do realize you're just a guy with rats on his head. You need to go take a shower. That's all I see here. A man in need of a shower and another job. That's all I see. But you see other things, other values that you attach to it. How can I get this man, if I went travel to the rat temple, how can I get him to see himself as a man with rats on his head? That's it. You can't unless you get him to step outside of the box. The box being the frame of mind or the framework that they think within. If I can get them to step outside of it, they'll see what's wrong with it. And there are examples of that. Amr ibn al-Jamuh is a companion, and he had an idol made of wood. And first thing when he'd wake up, he'd go to this idol. His sons became Muslim, and they want him to realize this thing is useless. So they took it and threw it in the trash at night. He woke up, looked everywhere, couldn't find it, found it in a dump with trash. He brought it home. They said he was cleaning it and oiling it again, and he was threatening, by Allah, if I found the one who did this to you, I would do this and do that to him. Then, next night, he goes to bed again. They took it and threw it in the trash. He woke up, found it in the trash, comes back very angry. That night, he puts a sword. This is a grown man, and he's an intelligent man. He put a sword around its neck. He hung a sword around its neck. And he said, if they come to throw you away this night, defend yourself. And he's intelligent. But wait a minute. You have never seen this thing move ever. يعني it never did this. Never. So why are you expecting it to take the sword off its neck, remove it, and say, come, come? Why? Isn't it strange? It's very strange, and he's intelligent, radiallahu anhu. But he was inside the box. When you're inside the box, you can't see what's wrong with what you're doing. When we were small children, we went to Thailand for vacation. And when we were kids, we used to laugh at the... we don't do that, but now as kids now, you can't blame kids. As kids, we used to laugh at people because every store, every restaurant, they have a little god. And it was summer. And they had an idol, yani. And they have this food in front of this idol, and the food gets dry because it's summer. And they take it and put fresh food, sometimes twice a day. And we used to laugh at them with each other. We'd say, look, and we were like 7. And we'd say, don't they realize that he's not eating and he's never, ever eaten? How come they don't ask him, hey, what's wrong, God? I noticed you've never taken a bite in the last 60 years. We used to laugh at them. Is it because 8-year-olds were smarter than these 50-year-olds? No. The 8-year-old was outside the box and the 60-year-old was inside. And because they were inside, they couldn't see what's wrong with what they're doing. If you take the narration of Umar, and I know the narration of him burying his daughter alive, it's a weak narration. Yani. But suppose just for the sake of the lesson, if we took the narration of him building the god, the idol out of dates, then he apologizes. I'm so sorry, I have to eat your right foot or right leg, then left leg, then right arm, then left arm, then the torso, then I'm so sorry, but I'm very hungry because he was traveling. It's the only food was this god made of dates. I have to eat your head now. But at the time, he's sincerely apologizing to this idol. And then later on, according to the narration, that would make him laugh. It's funny later on because he's outside the box. So your task is if someone has a strange belief, يعني, or a belief that doesn't make sense, whether it be believing in more than one God, polytheism, Trinity, or you know any kind of Buddhism, or this kind of weird, I've met a Wiccan pagan one time. And she was telling me the weirdest stuff. It's just so weird. What? How could you believe something like this? Yeah. Your job is to get them to step outside of the box. When you step outside of the box, you can see what's wrong with your belief system. You can take another unbiased and analytical look at your belief system. Like maybe some of you, growing up, the teacher will tell you to write something on the board. And while you're writing on the board, you think, I can be a teacher. This is easy. When you sit in your chair, what's wrong with the sentence that you wrote? Have you ever had that before? They don't make you write on the board here, ever? Ever? Don't you, when there's no teacher, write on the board then? Yeah? And then what, excellent. And then what happens to that sentence? When you sit back in your seat, you see that your sentence was slanting. You thought, oh, I'm a professor now. Hmm? But you didn't see it slanting. Only when you sit back, when you step out. Those of you who are painters or have ever taken art class, they teach you to step back from your painting, to look at it from far, from afar. You can see what's wrong with it, the proportions, if something is bent. So this is what you're trying to do. You're trying to get this step and see what's wrong with what they believe. You do that by asking certain questions that get them to question the belief. Now, there's a field of study called rhetorical criticism. Yeah, it's a very, very interesting field. Yeah, and in this field, one of the scholars in this field, he studied something called conversion theory. He studied when people convert from anything to anything. They convert from, you know, Christianity to Islam, or from Judaism to Christianity, or from Republican to being a Democrat, any kind of conversion. And he found there's a step, the first step is common and is there in every type of conversion. And the first step is always, almost always, the individual will start to doubt their own belief system. And there's no Christian who's walking around with very strong belief and suddenly he's Christian. Always, step one, he starts to doubt what he's believing in. When he doubts what he's believing in, he starts to look elsewhere. It's almost always the procedure. I doubt this, then I look, or it could be like I had strong belief and someone gave me something and a Muslim showed me some verses or something that made me start to doubt. And then when I'm doubting, now I start to explore. Yeah? So that's the of coming with these questions that get people to think outside of the box. Let me see how many I have up here. If not, we might borrow Remy's notes. And by the way, this was a technique that Ibrahim alayhi salam used in Surah Al-Anbiya. So his people went out to the to have their celebration, and Ibrahim alayhi salam, you wear glasses? You wear glasses? Yes. You do? What happened? They broke? Oh, you forgot to bring. Okay. Yeah. He was doing this. To some of you who don't wear glasses, what that means, but if you take off your glasses, you squint or you pull your eye out like this, you see clearer. Yeah. Anyways, just wanted to make sure you were aware of the fact that you need glasses. Yeah. You're like, no, I don't need glasses. Why are you doing this then? So basically, they all went out, and then he went into the town center and destroyed all the little idols and left the big one. When they came back, who did destroy idols? Well, we heard a young man named Ibrahim mention them. So they brought him, almost like a tribunal now. They brought him. Did you do this to our idols, Ibrahim? And who did? And he said, well, ask the big one. He was there. He saw everything. Ask him. So for them, it made them think that, you know what? The little ones couldn't defend each other. The big one couldn't defend the little ones. And now the weakest point, because maybe you're helpless, right? But even the helpless person can complain later on and cry. Even the most helpless individual will say, Wallahi, they came and they destroyed everything and they took everything. He can cry, but he can't even complain. So the next verse, Allah Azza wa Jalla says, فَرَجَعُوا إِلَىٰ أَنفُسِهِمْ. So they turn to themselves. Ibn Kathir says, and others, they say, actually a lot of the Mufassirin say, it means that the blame themselves for leaving Ibrahim alone with the idols because they heard him mention them before. But in the Tafsir Tobi and Ibn Sa'd and others, they say that فَرَجَعُوا إِلَىٰ أَنفُسِهِمْ means they turned to themselves and they said, he's right. He's right. These idols are useless. They can't defend each other. He couldn't defend them, and he can't even tell us what's happening. Because in other verses, Ibrahim alayhi salam says, ask the big one. If he can answer, ask him. So, but of course, then later on, again, they encourage each other upon their kufr, and they built the fire, and you know the rest of the story. But the point is, Ibrahim alayhi salam, for a moment, got them to step outside the box and realize, this makes no sense. Just like the sons of Amr ibn al-Jamuh. So, to finish that story, that third night, then, they take the idol out, throw it in the dumpster. One narration says, they tied it to the carcass of a dead dog. And then he came, and he stood over it like this, and he basically said, if you cannot push away harm or bring benefit to your own self, how can you do that for me? That event, that third event, got him to step out of the box, and he left that and he became Muslim. Your job, without throwing things in the trash, your job is to get people to step outside of the box, and you do that by asking questions that get people to think. And I'll give you examples of some simple ones. We sat down with some missionaries and we asked them, we started by asking this top question. This is a very easy question. I think all of you can answer this question. Is the Trinity three in one or one in three, according to Christians? Three in one. Sister said it very quickly. That's it. Three in one. That's what they say. They've always said three in one. So these were five people in the class, in the university, who taught Bible study. That was their job. They just go around campus teaching the Bible. We asked them that question, and they couldn't answer it. And they were all thinking. And I told them, the brother with me, I just told him, just be quiet. We're going to sit out this awkwardness. We're going to sit it out. Let them just sit awkwardly, thinking. Then in the end, we had to give them the answer. Of course, you believe it's three in one, because if you believe one in three, you're admitting to worshiping three different gods. And then suddenly they all looked up. Yes, of course. Why did it take them so long? Because they never thought about that. What they were thinking all this time, three in one means two, three in one. One in three would mean one, two, three. They never thought about it. Yeah? How many gods were there during the 3 days when Jesus was dead? Jesus, according to the gospel, died for 3 days. During these 3 days, how many gods were there? Still three? Or two? Or still one? Either way, you say there's a problem. Because if you say still three, that means he didn't die, he was still there, he went up to the heavens. No. Your gospel said he will be resurrected on the third day. So he wasn't there. So we said 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals, and they'll tell you 1. And now 1 is gone, so 1 plus 1 equals, and they'll tell you 1. But while they're telling you all this, they're very embarrassed now, because it's very embarrassing material. Yeah? Then, so what effect did his absence have on the universe? You say they're co-equal. So if one is gone, that means 33% of the work wasn't done, being done. Yeah? If so, what happened? Did the other gods have to do like extra shift or something? Seriously, let me ask you this. If you work at a company and you leave for 1 month and no one notices and work and operation is just the same without you, what should that company do to you? Fire you. You're useless. Yeah? So here, did they do extra work? Or was there no effect when he was gone, and so on and so forth? Kinds of questions that have problems with them. Why, if the Trinity is the most important part of Christian belief, why is there not a single clear verse that mentions Trinity clearly? Our number one message is Tawheed. Every page of the Quran has Tawheed in it. Multiple hadith have Tawheed in it. Multiple warnings against shirk. But this is the most important thing in your religion, and you don't have a single clear mention of it. All you have is just vague hints. Doesn't make sense. You're asking all these questions and you're starting to think something is wrong here. So it always starts with the person, his confidence in his own belief system will begin to crumble in order for him to start to consider others. Can I borrow your book again, Remy? Thank you for coming, by the way. Very useful. Okay, and I'd just like to read some of the arguments that were written by, hold on a second. These are really good. Other questions like, who died on the cross? Is it a man or a god? If a man died, what's the significance of a man dying on the cross? Why is a regular man's death expiation for everyone's sin and on and on? And if it's a god, what kind of god dies? Either way, you have a problem. Was Adam forgiven for his sin? And sometimes they'll say yes. You trap them, yeah? So you're getting them to think outside the box. Find out there are many things wrong with what you believe. So we believe, and this is how you trap, yeah? But nicely. By the way, sometimes you can say the strangest, maybe even harshest things to someone, but you say them nicely, politely, and the person will be smiling. Yeah. Said these same things in any other way, there would be a fight. But you can be very polite, yeah? So be very gentle. Like I said, I warned you yesterday, I'm excited now telling you the story, but I don't speak to non-Muslims this way. So be very gently, yeah? So, we said, okay, look, in Islam we believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is forgiving so long as you repent sincerely. He'll forgive any sin you commit. And we believe that Allah is so merciful that when Adam sinned against him, Adam repented and Allah forgave him. Do you believe that Allah forgave Adam when Adam repented? And if they say yes, we have a problem. And if they say no, they have a problem. If they say no, we'll be like, what kind of God is this that he cannot forgive even when someone cries and repents? As one sheikh, he asked some priest, he said, how do you guys forgive? They said, what do you mean? He said, how do you guys forgive when someone does something wrong against you? They said, we just forgive. That's easy. You don't have a technique or procedure. They said, no, we just forgive. He said, you guys just casually forgive. But God couldn't forgive for thousands of years. He was angry until someone else had to come and die, which isn't saving and it's not forgiving anyways, right? Let's say someone accidentally kills a Muslim. So the family, they have the choice to forgive, right? Or they can have the person killed. So, eye for an eye, or soul for a soul here. So imagine they have the person killed, and then whatever scenario where you can forgive or have the person killed, okay? So they have the, and then when they're talking to their friends, yeah, well, he killed our brother by mistake, but alhamdulillah, we forgave him. You had him killed. Yeah, we forgave him. You didn't forgive him, you had him killed. When someone dies, then you didn't forgive. You got paid back in full. So when you say, God is so forgiving, he had to kill someone who had nothing to do with it in order to forgive people. That's not forgiving, really. But the point is, he has to say yes. If he says no, what kind of God isn't forgiving? And if he says yes, he was forgiven. Okay, if he was forgiven, why did Jesus then have to come and die for the sin of Adam if that sin was forgiven? Bam, you're trapped. But one time this guy, he was a bit smart. Said, well, I don't know. It never says in the Bible that Adam asked for forgiveness. And he's right. The Bible doesn't say that. But that's still a problem for him. So you're telling me, this righteous man, this prophet who lived in the heavens in paradise, and he was given so much of blessings and graces of Allah, and he enjoyed all that. Then when he disobeyed Allah, he never once felt bad. He never once repented. He never once asked for forgiveness. And again, they're looking down in shame. Yeah? A polytheist believes in more than one God. So someone believes in more than one God. I want to show them that this belief doesn't make sense. And remember the story I told you last night at the end about the man who took that page that Remy has? I'm going to make everyone bother you after this class. There's a page that Remy is holding right now. Okay? Everyone's going to ask you for it. Yeah? That page, I kept it. I never changed a single word or dot in it because I used to not teach it. I used to tell the students, I'm just going to skip the page because you just read it for yourself. And the brother just went home, called his Hindu friend, and read the page from beginning to end. His Hindu friend became Muslim over the phone. And then the guy in Australia did the same thing, and his friend became Muslim over the phone. Basically, the page just throws some arguments at the idea of having more than one God. If someone says, I believe in more than one God, there are multiple things you can do. Number one, ask for the source. The only religious source or book that has no mistake about it, and we know where it came from, and has no mistakes or contradictions, is the Quran. The fact that his book is not the Quran, you already know. Even if you don't know the book, you know it has problems with it. You can go down that route. Or you can say, so you're saying the guy said there's seven gods. There's seven gods. Are these gods all equal or are they not equal? If they're all equal, we have a problem. If they're not equal, we have a problem. Because if they're not equal, which is the stronger one? God number four is the strongest one. Well, if he's the strongest one, let's say he has 50% of the muscle. Number five has 10% of the muscle, this one has 5%, 4%, whatever. Why would I waste time with this 4% muscle God? Why would I waste time with him? I'll just focus on God number four, who has 50% of the muscle, and I have a good relationship with him. On the day of judgment, God number four is going to, you never worship me, come here, and the God number four is going, hey, wait, he's with me, he's okay, I like him. Yeah? So, if one God is stronger than the other, why waste time with the other gods? If they have different jobs, and one God, let's say, is a God of love and mercy, and then the other God is a God of anger and war, and okay, I'll just worship this one to please, then the other one. So every way you look at it, you'll find a problem. And that's why one of the scholars, he did a study, Christian, yani, I don't know if we can use that term, but one of the Christian scholars, yani, within their field, he did a study and he found in America that more people love God the Son than God the Father. Why? Because the Father is the angry one who couldn't forgive them, and the Son is the one who loved them so much that he came and put his life on the line. That's why in America, something good happens to someone, they immediately, thank you, Jesus. Jesus. Everything, Jesus. Praise Jesus. All the time. But and you just call them on whatever you have.
Pardon?
You just call them on what, and if you, yeah, some are for business, so I have business, like,
okay.
If I don't have a family, I never call the one for family, yeah? Yeah?
Pardon?
If I don't have a family, then I can never call the one, and I don't have to call the one for families if I don't have a family.
Yeah, because they've got thousands of gods, so yes, they all...
Okay, very good. All you have to do is just keep asking questions about this idea that he gave you. Because you know it has problems. The way to find problems is to keep asking questions. You don't have to be rude. Just keep, okay, let me understand this then. So these gods, let's say there are 10,000 gods. And some religions have more than that, right? In the millions. So let's say there are 10,000 gods. And in my whole life, I only worship four. What does that, just keep asking them. What does that mean in your religion? The person goes to paradise or the hellfire? If they say paradise, then what's the value of these other gods? What is four out of 1,000? So you tell me you have, 996, absolutely useless gods that have no self-respect, that you can just ignore them and nothing will happen to you. And may him just keep asking questions about that. So if they're, and if they're co-equal, all of them, how did they become co-equal? Was there a bigger god that divided their power? Or did they have a meeting and they decided to, you know, okay, god number two, you're too smart, he's dumb, give him some of your intelligence. You have too much muscle, give him some of that. Every way, if you say they're equal, you have a problem. If you say they're not equal, you have a problem. If you say they're equal and they have different jobs, you have a problem. The ones that are not being worshipped, what's the ruling there? What's their value if you can just ignore them? What, and then, and how bad, how can I mean, if there are 1,000 gods, what can I get away with? Just worshipping one out of the 1,000? Or do I have to at least worship 50% of them? And if they're like a million, how do I do that even? And just keep asking question after question. And they don't have to be rude questions. Could you help me understand this? I have a question, and I'm sorry to keep asking you this, but could you explain to me, how does this work then? And how about on the Day of Judgment? Oh, there's no Day of Judgment. Then how, the retribution for sins, remember we spoke about, did we speak about retribution? We didn't. And Muhim, the point is, keep asking questions to get them to think outside of the box. The thing about, look, we don't have time to go into how to do this technique with every scenario, but the thing about it is that all, any issue related to da'wah has been answered already. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel. I want to know how to answer if someone says, why did your prophet marry a young woman? Aisha radiallahu anha. I don't have to like go and research, just Google it, and someone already did the research for you and gave the arguments for you. Why did the Prophet ﷺ do that? Google it. You have to learn these arguments and you have to know them well. Okay, let me see here. So learning well, practice. Even your da'wah speech, you practice it. What am I going to say to people? How do I describe Allah? You practice it. You practice it while you're driving. You practice it while you're in your, you know, in the bus or on the train. You always practice your da'wah speech. Yeah? And I always talk about how in the past I would always be driving and practicing giving da'wah to someone, explaining how Jesus was not divine, going over the verses in my head, chapter this, verse that, and all that. You practice it. Then when you do it, people be like, ooh, how you do it so, what do you think? I practiced it. I didn't just suddenly wake up and, hey, let me just speak about something randomly. You practice it all the time. And that's how they say that, that's how you build confidence, they tell you. You have to practice something so many times that it just comes like breathing after that. That's the whole thing with, you know, if you want to use any other analogy with any sport or with martial arts, you know, with martial arts, why do you practice the kata, the steps so many times so that it becomes your natural reflex and reaction when you're in a real fight. This is a true story. One time, this guy was showing off to these guys. He was doing all the steps and they were beautiful steps. He was doing this and block and this and hit and he looked so nice, yeah? But obviously he didn't practice them enough. Then a brother, this is a true story, just slapped him hard. And the guy immediately started going like this. What happened to the all these beautiful moves? Gone, because he didn't practice enough. So they keep practicing and practicing the martial artists so that when they're in the real situation, their natural reflex are those they practiced. Violent example, I just couldn't think of anything else. But you have to keep repeating something and practice it until it just flows naturally. You meet some good du'at and they just have a natural flow because they practiced it. So I used to practice in the car a lot. And I'd drop my brother, you know, to school or to, he used to go to taekwondo class. I would always be practicing. He would always tell me, why are you speaking to yourself? And I always tell him, I'm practicing a speech. And one day I'm driving him, I'm quiet and he's speaking to himself. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm practicing a speech. It was very little that I'm practicing a speech. What speech is this? How to play video games or what? We have to practice. And this is for Allah Azza wa Jalla. You find people with things in the dunya, they persist and they try and attempt after attempt after attempt. When it comes to the religion of Allah, huh? I spoke to this one guy, didn't work, huh? I'll find something else to do. Go dig that hole, put the durian in it again. Try. Yeah? Sometimes you get hurt when, and you feel bad when you hear about, you know, inventors and how many times they tried. You know how many times Edison tried for the light bulb? Huh? Thousands of times. Thousands of times. Do you guys have the vacuum cleaner? Dyson? I believe it's the best Dyson, I mean the best vacuum cleaner invented right now. It's a bagless vacuum that never loses suction, no matter how full it gets. So Miles Dyson is the inventor, the British guy or something, and he went through 1,000 prototypes. 1,000! You think after 433, he's like, you know what, I'm not good at this. Let me do something else. No, this British guy kept going. You think at 679 attempts, he'd be like him. That's what British people say, right? Right? At number 900, you think he'd be like, oh, 1,000, and he got it. Now every other company tries to steal his design and change it a little bit, you know, to make something like it. In America, we have a cleaning agent called 409. It's called a very famous, very old cleaning agent. It's called 409. It's a cleaning detergent. It's called 409 because they tried the formula until number 409 when they got it finally. People keep trying for the dunya. And for Allah, it's just, barakah. Islam is the fastest growing religion. Really? How? Without any da'wah work, it's the fastest growing religion? I'll tell you how. Because of babies. Yeah. Childbirth. You see a white guy and his wife. Come here, Timmy. You see a smaller guy with... Nine children. Anyway, sorry about that. Even people who write stories, craft and jinn and magic and sorcery. J.K. Rowling, the lady who wrote what? Harry Potter. Yeah? She 12... Sure? And they said, no, we're not going to publish this book. She had the second one, we're not going to publish this book. Third one, fourth one, fifth one. Anyone else would just throw it in the trash. The 12th one said, okay. And now look, make us sick with that story now. Anyways, Nam? I want to talk about something called learned helplessness. So when you teach yourself to become helpless, I'm not good at this, I can't do it. Never say you can't. And never allow someone to tell you why you can't. You know, some of you have probably had some great business ideas, right? And you're not millionaires right now, why? Because some jerk, with all due respect, because it might be someone's father, right? But some guy, you told him this great idea and they told you, nah, it won't work. And then they give you 5 reasons why it won't work. So if I ever share an idea with someone, one wise man told me, if you have a good idea, don't tell it to anybody. Just tell it to a few people. Positive people, yeah? Because you tell people, they'll tell you 5 reasons why it won't work. So when someone tells me why it won't work, I cut them off. They'll give me reasons why it will work. I'm not an idiot. I thought of why it won't work. But give me reasons why it will work. But that's what people know how to do now. Just to point out what's wrong with things. And some of us are trained like that. If you're trained like that, untrain yourself. They're trained to walk into a beautiful place and look for something wrong with it. Yeah? Walk into a beautiful and just try to find something wrong. It's like, appreciate all the good. No. There it is. And he's happy now. Alhamdulillah. If there was nothing wrong with this place, well, how can I live? Yeah? Train themselves to do that. Or train themselves and they teach themselves that they're failures. When we were children, we used to never find any task impossible. And my younger brother was more than me. He would see the most difficult thing on television. The guy flips like this and does how many spins in the air, then he lands inside a glass of water. And then my brother would just look at me and say, easy, I could do that. Because it's a human, see look, if this was like someone from outer space who came and did it, you say, okay, I can't do it because he's from Mars and I'm just a human. But this is a human like you who needs food and nutrition and water and air. And he just trained and conditioned himself. And if you go through the same rigorous training, you can do the same thing. Don't ever let people tell you, you can't do it, it's impossible, and the women have to suffer with this a lot. You're not allowed to, your voice is aura, all these kinds of things, and you feel, okay, I can't do it. And like I said, it's worse when we teach ourselves to be helpless. And this is a term that was put together by a psychologist. His name is Martin Seligman. And he basically explained, like, one of the best examples is the circus elephants. You know, the circus, you have the circus here? Yeah? Still? Okay, anyways. So the circus, you know, they bring circus elephants and all kinds of animals. And the way they tie these elephants down in the old days, they would put a rope around the elephant's leg and they would beat it into the ground with a pin or a peg this long into the ground. The elephant never escapes. Even though the elephant is so strong, with one leg he can bring down the whole circus tent. But he never tries to break this little nail out of the ground, this peg. Because when the way they trained the elephant is that when the elephant was a baby, they tied him with the same thing and put the peg to the ground, and the elephant was weak and could not escape. So when the elephant grows up, it's able to escape, but it never tries. Why? Because it learned to become helpless. That's called learned helplessness. And we do the same thing to ourselves all the time. How many people in here, and let's be honest with each other, and I used to do this, would say, I'm not good with roads. I used to do that. How many people here say, I'm not good with names? A guy looks at you and he tells you his name. Why? You brain dead or something? The guy's like, my name's Abdullah. You're like, huh? You speak two, everyone in here at least speaks two languages, true or false. Some of you, mashallah, tabarakallah, speak three languages. Languages are composed of thousands of words. The guy says, my name's Abdullah. Huh? Why? So what happens is when you say, I'm not good with names, sorry to make, I know you put your hand up, I don't want to call you out, but, or how many in here say, I'm not good with math? Yeah? And I used to do that also, I'm not good with math. So you're setting yourself up to fail. If you tell yourself, I'm not good at math, I'm going to fail at math, why would you suddenly succeed at math? You're already telling yourself you're a failure. I used to tell myself, I'm not good with roads. I used to always say this. And one time I got lost, I'm not making this up, and I'm not exaggerating. I got lost in the street behind my house. I'm serious. And I called my roommate, and I told him, listen, I'm on this street called Wilson Boulevard, and it's a main road down behind the house. And I'm on a road called Wilson Boulevard. How do I get back home? He started laughing. He said, you're behind the house. Just come this way. That's it. You know? But I used to fail at learning and memorizing roads because I kept telling myself, I'm not good at that. So I learned to become helpless with that. So those of you who say you're not good with names, you are good with names. It's just one name. You know, and there are ways, I don't want to call anyone out, but there are ways to memorize names. And you watch some of those, on TEDx, seen this last night, people who enter these memory competitions where they memorize things. So they'll look at a deck of cards, they'll shuffle a deck of cards. You know, how many cards are there? 52? So they'll look at it, and in the world records, in 21 seconds, the person memorized the order of the whole deck. And he would, like, the number and the, what do they call that? The ish? Shape? Yeah. So it'll tell you 2 of clubs, 4 by 9 of diamonds. A jack of hearts, like that. 21 seconds. And they have techniques, and I'm not going to go into them. They'll explain the techniques. But you can remember one person's name. Yeah? And and they tell you your visual memory is better than other types of memory. So you can imagine things. It's last time we were in i'tikaf, right? And there was a big circle of brothers making i'tikaf. We're getting to know each other for the first time. So every brother said where he's from, just his city and his name. City and name. City and name. When we're done, I just went through and I told, or actually everyone spoke a little bit about themselves. So I went back, told everyone the name in the circle with whatever they said. This guy said, this is my third i'tikaf. I said, this is Brother Muhammad, that's his third i'tikaf. And then everyone's like, oh, I said, no, it's very easy. And I still remember the names now from that circle. And right now I can see exactly where everyone was because your visual memory is very strong. So there were 3 Muhammads. So Muhammad, I don't need any technique to memorize Muhammad. True or false? There were 3 Muhammads. I remember there were 2 next to each other. And between, there were 2 people, then the 3rd Muhammad. And there was Abdullah here. Do I need a technique for these? Okay. There was Adnan right here. Adnan. Remember his name? If you're an old Arab, there was a very famous cartoon called Adnan Ulina. Yeah? And I had a cat named Lena. So when Brother Adnan was sitting, I imagined Lena on his head. Visual. Okay, there's another champion in memorizing in America, and they take him to a movie theater, and people just tell him their names, and then when they come out, he tells them back. And then he explains how he did it. And every time he would imagine something silly. Yeah? So Adnan. Then there was Brother Yusuf, and my best friend, his name is Yusuf. Then across from him here, there was Benyamin. What's? Thank Yusuf and Benyamin, brothers. But Prophet Yusuf, his brother, from the same mother, was Benyamin. That was an easy connection. You see how easy it is? Everyone in here can do it. Everyone can do it. But this is what we tell ourselves. I'm not good. It's easy. Okay. When is the first break? Did we go? Oh, wonderful. Okay. Now, the other thing we want to deal with, and we only have 4 minutes, but I'll start introducing. The other thing we want to deal with is being too shy. It's hard for me to go up to a complete stranger and say something. Okay, leave. Now we're talking about direct da'wah. How can I do that? And I personally, as I want to use myself as an example, if right now you tell me go in the street and start giving people da'wah, I'll feel awkward about it. Especially when I haven't done it in a long time. I feel really strange that, okay, now I'm going to go to complete strangers, get in their face, and start yelling things to them, and talking to them and telling them about Islam. And it's hard, I'll admit, as much as I've done it in the past, okay? It's still hard. But it's just like when you take a cold shower, okay? A cold shower, or you jump into a cold swimming pool, what happens? Just a few seconds, isn't it? It's a few seconds, then you're used to it. Then you don't even feel cold, right? Your water's cold here, beaches. Yeah, I went to a beach in Northern California. But like this, you're like, if I go in there, I will die. This will be janazah, straight death. Yeah. And then a half hour later, you're like, you're very comfortable in there because icy cold water. You're like, very comfortable. How did this happen? Yeah. So it's the same phenomenon. In the beginning, it's awkward. I speak to that person. And then Allah blesses you with some good experiences, nice conversations, handshakes, sometimes hugs with these complete strangers. It's fun. You know, du'at are addicted to da'wah because, believe it or not, it's fun. It's not just going to people, what about this? Let me show you. And then they'll tell you, well, let me show you. And just fighting. It's a lot of fun. You talk to people. You exchange phone numbers. You have a great time. It was wonderful talking to you. I hope to see you again. Take this and read it. If there's anything, this is my number. Call me. It's fun. Ask anyone who does street da'wah, and they'll tell you they enjoy it. Yeah, even people who argue, they love arguing, and that's why they enjoy it. Everybody enjoys it. Some people for the wrong reasons. So, we want to learn that to tell ourselves, yes, we can do it, and we can enjoy it as well. But I have to push myself beyond my shyness. I have to withstand it for a few seconds, and then it's going to be really, really normal. So, we'll stop here, we'll take a break, and then we'll resume. Any announcements? طيب صلى الله وبارك على محمد جزاكم الله خير for attentive listening. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته.